This week in Retronauts, Glyph, Laugh, Love. Hi, everyone. Welcome to Retronauts. Oh, we just looked at 691. Yes, I do have better memory recall than a goldfish. I am Jeremy Parrish, swimming slowly in my tiny little fishbowl, looking out at the world. And the world, it turns out, looks like a Castlevania map. That's cool. What a great kind of world, as long as you are not afraid of vampires. Yes, this is part two of the Metroidvania Book Club, the first installment, which talks about Castlevania Order of Ecclesia. Last time we did this, and I forgot to look up the episode for that, but not too long ago, we introduced this whole crazy madcap thing and explained what the Metroidvania Book Club is all about. But in short, it's a hopefully consistent group of people who get together, play a Metroidvania game, and then converge to talk about it in book club format. The idea is that each game we tackle we'll discuss in multiple episodes, kind of break up the game, and that also gives an opportunity for the community to play along and to comment on our Discord. And we have a lot of community comments and thoughts on Castlevania Order of Ecclesia to read in the back half of this episode, which is about the back half of the game. So it's like the back quarter of the book club, if you can do the math. Because you can, because you are powered by Atari Jaguar. So joining you, or leading this podcast, and being joined by a group of 16 bitters who all together with me add up to 64 bits. Chris Sims could not make this episode because he was driving somewhere. I don't know. Let's start here in the U.S. Who is our returning guest?
I'm Critical K. Willard. I'm so not on top of it. What should I even say for an introduction?
I don't know. You can talk about how much you love ALF for Master System, and I can call you a liar.
Oh, crap. There goes my one.
Mine too.
All right. I'm Critical K. Willard. I have a YouTube channel called Critical Hit, where I write and talk about forgotten video game history, the really obscure stuff, and also a lot of Metroid content.
All right. Thank you, Kate. Canada person.
Hello, I'm Nadia Oxford. I am Canada person. I'm on Retronauts quite a bit myself, as the guest and as a host. I am a creature of chaos, much like the creature of chaos we are talking about in this game. By the way, I discovered a cat power, so I'm good. Best game ever.
You discovered a cat power?
I discovered a power that turns me into a cat, and it's really good.
Oh, yes, the transformation.
No, in real life, too. I found something.
Oh, nice. A cat.
Even better.
Bye.
So a full moon turns someone into a wolf. What turns you into a cat? There is no cat star. There's a dog star.
A full sun? I don't know.
So the cataclysm. Every day, the sun comes up and you're like, oh, not this again.
But I'm a cat, so I love the sun, so it's all good.
Oh, okay. All right. Take a nap. Finally, in the UK.
Hello, I'm Stuart Jip, and the game can also be a hat.
The what?
That was just me doing a hilarious Peter Griffin Family Guy reference, the funny dad from Family Guy.
Oh,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah. Hilarious show that we all love and have no issues with whatsoever.
I think I saw like half an episode back in 2002 or so and said, I'm good.
That was my take as well.
But that is not to judge anyone who does enjoy the show, because there's lots of things. In fact, I would say I have built my entire online personality and my profession around liking things that most people are like, why? So more power to you.
I mean, I've built my entire online personality, life in general, around imitating Peter Griffin, my favorite TV dad. So I'm here for it, you know. I got the look. I got the brains. I got 6,000
chicken vaginas, please.
See, I laughed. It's funny.
That's a good fun. That was joking. That was good.
It's a good bit. I wish this was a Family Guy episode.
There's something inherently funny about mispronouncing food names, like when Zap Brannigan says something about guacamole. It's great. I love it.
So you would.
Champagne.
Champagne. Indiana Jones and the Last Crudité. What?
So now I'm feeling like the pattern here seems to be everyone does an intro that makes Jeremy go, what? And now I'm like, I should just come up with some, I should redo my intro with some non sequitur and try to get another what. And then.
That's not actually a requirement of our intros on the show. That's just their personality defects. So
yeah.
Don't feel like you have to join the crowd. It's okay. Just be yourself. Be your own true self, as in persona. Defects.
Okay.
Did I say defects? I meant charming personality quirks.
There you go.
Yeah.
So if any listeners know who I am, please write in and let me know, because I'm still, I don't know.
Well, this can be the search for Dracula and the search for Spock and the search for Kate all in one. I don't know where Spock factors into this, but we'll figure it out. He's got to be somewhere in the castle.
He's knocking about.
Typical.
Spocking about, I should have said.
The Night Spocker. So when last we left Castlevania Order of Ecclesia, I believe we had traversed the entirety of not Transylvania. Does it actually take place in Transylvania? I don't remember.
I don't think they say. They insinuate.
It takes place in Ecclesia.
Random churchy land.
No, it doesn't take place in Ecclesia. Ecclesia is the organization. And apparently people looked it up. The Japanese version is Ecclesia. So, we can still say Ecclesia. Because when I was a kid and went to church, they always said Ecclesiastes, not Ecclesiastes. So, I don't know. It's a made-up word that they invented for this video game, so call it whatever you like. I don't get on people's case when they say Gradius, even though it's Gradius.
Is it Gradius?
It is Gradius.
I keep saying Gradius, and people keep correcting me, and I keep thinking they're wrong. But I've been right the whole time.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, I'm going to punch so many people.
Don't even get me started on Darius.
Oh no! What about Bubble Lead and Bubble Lead? No, let's not start.
Oh no, that's canonical now. That's been.
Oh, you're right.
That's a solved problem. None of these things are Castlevania Order of Ecclesia, however. So why don't we talk about that instead? So in the previous episode, like I said, we talked about the glyph system. We talked about the story, the protagonist, and basically the structure of the world and how the world map functions. Some of us love it. Some of us have criticisms, and that's okay because we still like this game. But for this episode, we are talking about basically the second half of the game, which is entirely hidden if you don't play the game correctly. Although in this one, it's pretty easy to tell if you've whiffed it and done the wrong thing, because the bad ending is pretty obviously bad, and it kind of goes out of its way to make it clear what you need to do to get the correct ending. It's not like Symphony of the Night, where you could, you know, kill Richter and Maria's like, well, that sucks. I guess there probably was some way that didn't have to happen, but hell if I know, and then runs off. this is much more, it's telegraphed quite a bit more.
Yeah.
So because this is a podcast specifically recorded for the sake of people who have been playing this game with us, we can spoil everything.
Yay!
So we can talk about how you get to the back half of the game, which is the actual Castlevania, the real deal, the real McCoy, the MacGuffin that you're pursuing, even. Castlevania is not as big as the overworld of Ecclesia, but it's pretty close. It's, I would say, probably about two-thirds the size, and it's much less copy-paste than parts of the world. Like, I mentioned this last episode, but basically almost every overworld space in Order of Ecclesia has a counterpart, which is just a palette swap with a different layout and, you know, a different arrangement of enemies. Castlevania itself does not have that. Each of the areas is really pretty distinct and has its own look and also its own kind of structural style. There are, mm-hmm. you know, real meaningful differences to the different sections of Castlevania. And it feels, you know, like this is kind of where they started with the design and then worked backward from here, because this feels like, you know, they weren't tired yet. They hadn't started crunch when they put this together. So it's a very satisfying space, in my opinion, but perhaps you disagree. Would someone care to disagree? Call me out.
I agree that the corridors are really interesting. I think when you first enter the area, you kind of get this twisted sort of hallway. Like, it's a very unsettling looking place. And that's a, as you say, a nice change from the copy paste of, like, there's like three areas look the same. But the problem I have with it is I really enjoy exploring it, but man, those bosses are something else. Especially Elagor, whatever you, Centaur Man, whatever you want to pronounce his name. I hate him. Mm-hmm. So, it's really more of a space for getting to where you need to go so you can just kind of get your ass kicked by the boss, kick the boss's ass in turn. Although you will certainly find, like, a lot of helpful items and power-ups to kind of get you over that last hump. That's what it's all about in this case. And it's a really fun, satisfying part of the game. Frustration with the bosses excluded, which, I'll be honest with you, I made hearty use of the rewind button in the Castlevania collection.
Honestly, the only boss that I really had trouble with was Elagor, like you mentioned. I just felt like, am I doing something wrong? And then I read strategy guides and it said, no, you're not doing anything wrong, Jeremy. It's just a really balls hard boss.
Yeah, I feel like maybe that was my problem, is that it was trying to be Shadow of the Colossus was the new hotness, and you can have 2D wasn't that at the same time? I just remember being like, okay, they're trying to be Shadow of the Colossus.
Yeah, could be.
And it just felt like it didn't really, to do Shadow of the Colossus, like, if you do it right, obviously it's brilliant, but if you don't do it exactly so, it's not as brilliant.
It could have been inspired by God of War also.
That's true as well.
You know, it has very much that same style where you're sort of climbing a big monster and dismantling it, and it's not very mobile, but mm-hmm. You have to take apart different pieces and parts of it in order to weaken it. You know, even it's even got kind of a Zelda boss feel to it, with glowing red orbs and a giant eyeball in the back of its head. Like, there's something grotesque and Zelda-esque about Elagor, which go ahead.
I know. I was just going to interject the Castlevania series on the DS has already had, I think it's called Menace in Dawn of mm-hmm. Sorrow, which is much bigger even than Elagor, and that would have been closer to Shadow of the Colossus, which was 2005, when this game is 2008, I want to say.
Okay, yeah.
Not that I'm coming in with you're wrong. It's not my intention here at all, I apologize.
It's more of an actually.
It is more of an actually, yeah. spelled A-C-K, you know how it is. I think that this castle is fine. I don't particularly love it. I think there are areas like the Underground Labyrinth, which really did feel just like you're sort of descending past the same two enemies for quite a long period of time. Then you travel horizontally a bit, and then you're sort of ascending through the same two enemies again. Mm-hmm. And when you're ascending or descending in these games, it's when you're the most likely to get hit by something in the air, and there's a lot of that going on.
Yeah.
But I do also think in that area, it's interesting that you have the interstitial corridors that have, you know, the shadow projections on the background, which is obviously foreshadowing for the boss fight with
Blackmore.
Yeah. Hey, there it is. Wow, I can't believe it didn't occur to me. But I do like it. I think visually, I think it's very well drawn, which actually kind of goes a long way when you're doing the copy-paste. I don't like saying copy-paste, but they kind of are a bit, some of them.
Yeah.
No, it, having, it, it, having painstakingly drawn out all of these maps by hand, I can tell you with confidence that they are very copy-paste. Like, the Underground Labyrinth especially is guilty of that, where you have basically two types of structures. There's the vertical shafts, and then there's the horizontal corridors.
Yeah.
Some of the horizontal corridors are just big empty spaces. There's like nothing there. But then the vertical spaces are very dense, and they have like five or six different arrangements of platforms, but they all kind of function the same. It gets very samey.
The blue sort of squiddy enemies that are not only kind of dropping fire on the ground, which is sort of slightly imprecise where exactly it's going to go sometimes, but then when you defeat them, they burst into these things that also damage you, that also fly upwards. So when you're traveling upwards, it's really just like, if I ignore this thing, it might fly into me. But if I defeat... Oh, no, they don't turn into those. I'm thinking of another enemy. I've made a huge mistake already. But
I know what you're talking about. Yeah, but
they're talking about the balloon plants. Yeah,
I'm thinking of the balloon plants. I'm wrong. But no, the first part was correct, so that's fine. But leave this whole thing in, because I want them to know that I'm incompetent. Thank you. We're not gods like you think, us podcasters.
No.
We make errors, too.
We're more like demigods.
I was going to say we're demigods. We're... not the like most favorite demigod, so I want to get harassed by Hera all the time.
So I agree with what's been said generally. I'm not a big fan of a lot of difficult bosses, and the castle felt like there was like copy-paste stuff, like, but in a smaller way where it's a lot of like repeating things to expand it out. I think my favorite aspect of entering into the second half of the game was actually that middle portion where you get this new traversal ability that lets you go through walls that you can use in some of the earlier areas, and then you get to use a bunch in the new area. And on top of that, the way that you get it is like the best boss ending of the
game. That was a good boss fight. Yeah,
it turns the glyph theft mechanic into something that is, you know, actually a required mechanic. It's no longer just like, oh, you should do this if you can. It's requisite there. And also, it's kind of played for comedy. All the bosses in the castle have their own distinct feel. Like, Death is very much a Castlevania boss. I mean, he's just Death, you know? He's always going to be the same, more or less. He's going to have the scythe for a while, and then he's going to be like, okay, fine, I'll punch you to death instead. I know kung fu. Elagor, you know, he's just huge and basically a wall you have to dismantle while not dying. Then there's Blackmore, who is very tricky and has a really interesting gimmick. But then Wallman, the guy who gives you the traversal ability, is a total goofball that feels like almost like a comedy character. I'm sure there have been some Castlevania bosses that have been played for comedy, but it's not something they do very often. They usually have like characters with, you know, like minor enemies with comedic tics or something, like Yorick the skeleton that's kicking his own head around.
I love Yorick.
Catch up to it.
I love him so much.
Or the swordsman in Portrait of Ruin who won't fight Charlotte. He'll like they'll always kneel and give you a rose, and then you kill them, and they're like, "What, my lady?" So
reject me.
Exactly. Wallman is great because it's a puzzle battle. It's kind of like you're fighting this weird little gremlin guy who wants to be a Bomberman boss almost. And you have to kind of puzzle your way through the gimmick to win the battle while also avoiding getting blown up by all of his bombs.
There's I was going to say very quickly, there's also a really clever thing going on where this is around the time where I got the cat power up and I realized I just clawed the crap out of everything. And so I was doing that to this guy and it was really satisfying. But the thing is, he takes out a super potion if you keep going. And if you're quick, though, you can knock the super potion out of his hands and he'll be like, oh, and you can pick it up for yourself. That's great.
I kept waiting for him to do that again. I was like, oh, wow, maybe I can farm
this. I want to farm this.
But you can't.
Nope, they got you.
I like how the bosses in the castle, they are challenging, but they all have a sort of interesting use of space. Like, Eligor, obviously you're traveling around the whole boss. My frustration with Eligor is that I find the ground phase quite trivial. It just takes a long time. And then when you get up on his back, he's just horrible. And by that mm-hmm. point, you've already been fighting him for about 5 minutes. It's like, come on. But bosses like Blackmoor. Like, Blackmoor is one of my favorite Castlevania bosses because if you know how to dodge his attacks, which is not easy to do, you can defeat him quite quickly with, like, a death ring. But that's obviously, if you get hit once, you're taken out. But mm-hmm. the fact is, with him and in this game, if you get hit, like, 3 times, you're taken out. So it's not... I feel like the trade-off is worth it. So you end up in these kind of boss fights, which are extremely challenging and imposing. But then once you do figure out the patterns, you can take them down very quickly, which is very satisfying. And that seems to kind of carry through all of them, except for Eligor and obviously Dracula. I'm not sure if we're saving talking about him for later.
No, go ahead. He's one of the five
okay.
bosses.
I gotta say about Dracula in this game, what I love about this is I might have mentioned this on the last episode and I apologize if I'm repeating myself, but it's another subversion because in the Castlevania games, Dracula always transforms into a monster. And in this, he's just like, you know what? No, I've been just a standalone sprite, a single sprite who will open his cloak and shoot things at you. I've been doing that for about 20 years. I'm just going to start walking around, bitch. And
the way he walks is like, he's got murder on his mind too. He's like stomping. Yeah. Like he's, when I saw him walk, I'm like, holy shit. Dracula yeah. means business.
It's a genuinely quite, like, oh my Christ moment when it
and
happens.
And he has, like, a killer axe kick, too.
The last thing I expected was that Dracula could move now.
You don't know Dracula can move. Shit, it's all over.
Yeah.
I think my favorite two bosses of the entire game are the ones that have, like, a fun twist ending. The wall one, and then near the beginning of the game, the one where you get to, like, drop an elevator on that boss.
Oh, the crab. Yeah. Yeah.
Dracula. Like those, I wish more games had, like, they almost feel like action-y, action movie kind of twist to the end of like a set piece or something. Like, I don't
yeah.
know.
I think the older bosses do carry a set piece flavor to them because of the kind of the air quotes gimmicks that they carry. Like, again, Blackmoor, the gimmick is kind of you don't have room to maneuver. You are pretty much cornered to like one quarter of one screen and you just have to get good at dodging his like two attacks, which is the swipe combinations or the overhead balls, which aren't terribly difficult to avoid in and of themselves. But the fact that you're so panicked and crushed into this small space and he hits so hard, it gets very intimidating. It's interesting because Castlevania doesn't usually do that. They usually give you at least a screen to work with, but not here. It's different. It's new. And I like that a lot. I think all the bosses in this game are good Castlevania bosses, like memorable ones. And I don't think many of them are repeats of previous ones either, if any, apart from Dracula, which is really cool as well.
No, Blackmoor is really cool. It also has a breath weapon that can really get you.
Oh, yes, of course, the breath sort of laser thing it does. Yes, I forgot about that.
Yeah, and your hitbox is, Shinoa's hitbox is not exactly small.
One thing that disappointed me about that shadow fight is that he starts it by saying like that he wants to steal your shadow, but then if you do die, maybe I wasn't paying enough attention, but it seemed like a missed opportunity to actually do some horrific thing where you
That's
see
true.
Him stealing the shadow.
Yeah, especially like, the bosses like say things when you die
I
for the most
take
part.
Take your shadow.
I have to admit that I did not get good at Blackmoor. I just cheesed Blackmoor because I found the secret of stocking up on health items pretty early in the game. And so I never wanted for potions and things like that.
How did you stock up? I found that was like one of the most troubling things about the game.
So it took me a while to jog my memory, but this was a conversation that came out in Discord, and the secret is luck rings and gold rings, specifically the gold rings. So early on in the game, you can get a hold of a gold ring, and if you put it on, it increases the amount of money that characters drop, that enemies drop. And I don't remember exactly how I bumbled into this. It was totally by chance, but there's a room in the monastery at the beginning of the game, the first area you really fight through, that's just full of zombies. And, you know, they respawn infinitely. And if you put on a gold ring, there's a good chance that all the zombies will start dropping like high value cash bags.
Wow.
It doesn't seem to be consistent. There seems to be like a random seed generated when you restart the game or when you restart the area or something. But I found that either when I plowed through them, they would all drop big cash bags, or none of them would. It would be like a smaller amount of currency, which still isn't trivial. But if you put on two gold rings, then all of a sudden there's a good chance that that seed that generates will cause all the zombies to drop $500 cash bags. And, you know, those things pop up. You're killing like 10 a minute. So you can rake in thousands of dollars per minute by fighting through there. And so after like 15 minutes of just grinding in there, I started to feel kind of guilty. And if you, you know, put on some of the luck enhancement glyphs and, you know, accessories that boost your luck, it becomes even more likely. I think 500 is the max value they will drop. But still, like when I had like $40,000 in my inventory, I was like, well, I can literally afford anything in the game now. I feel like this is probably not how it's meant to be played, but also I don't mind because I can just stand there and wail on Blackmore and just keep using potions. Okay, that's fine. It's fine.
I don't even think I managed to get the recipe for the high potions. Like, you're supposed to get the mandrake root. And I ground for that while and I said, screw this.
Luck glyphs and luck raising items.
I found that if you can get the killer fish barbecue in the shop, that's an effective substitute. You stuck up on that. But I can't remember how you get that. I assume that's from one of the missions as well. I think it's odd how stingy the game actually is with the purchasables. But
it really is.
That was a big complaint. A recurring complaint in the Discord was that the game doesn't just make it hard to buy items, like in terms of earning cash, but also there's a lot of grinding for the elements to get, and you don't always know what you have to collect. It involves a lot of either poking around in areas, trying to suss things out by looking at the bestiary and see, like, oh, this guy has question marks, I should keep killing him, or just going to a strategy guide, one or the other. But I think the Killerfish barbecue is from some totally unintuitive enemy in one of the water spaces. It doesn't seem like it should drop that. Yeah. Or maybe it does. Maybe it is the killerfish that drops it. But there's some sort of like weird, extremely good item. I can't remember what it is that drops from enemies, but it doesn't make any sense that it would drop. It's like, here is a thing, but taxonomically, this thing should not be dropping that item. And yet it does.
If I'm not mistaken, this is something I meant to mention in the first episode. This was around the time when everyone was really big on the DS sharing knickknacks and items, like Zelda, the Zeldas in that particular time, especially Spirit Tracks, was one of those games where you had a bunch of chutchkas that you could collect to power up your train in particular, is what I remember. But there was always that one elusive item that you would theoretically have to ask a friend for. You should ask a friend for, unless you want to kill yourself grinding. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the same idea here, where I was kind of looking back at some old Reddit posts and people were saying, oh, have you tried, like, you know, getting someone to give you this? So it feels like maybe it was nerfed for that reason. It could be. It's just something that I remember happening on occasion back in the day.
Could be. I feel like Dragon Quest IX would do that a year later.
Yeah, I think so. But that really was a game that was built around sharing.
So something I appreciate about the castle here was the amount of platforming in it. Like, there's a lot of, as well as the sort of the corridor sections, which I'm not as fond of, there are areas like the sort of the clock tower-ish section where you're doing a lot of magnes into air double jumps to land on another magnes while you're avoiding like enormous circles of fire. I mean, that kind of get exemplified in like the training hall, which is a post-game secret area you can find in the castle, mm-hmm. I think. Which is another cool thing about the castle, that there's a second entrance to it that you have to find in a secret area elsewhere, which makes the world feel more interconnected than it really is. And is a nice little gimmick. But I did appreciate the amount of environmental stuff that's in there, and also like the puzzles. Like there's a section in the castle where you need to stack two blocks on top of each other in order to raise the water level to get out of a room, which I liked. It's only little things, but so many of the Castlevania games forget that it was a platformer as much as it was an action, like a fighting battle. I don't know what you'd call it, like a beating things up game. It's nice to bring that back, and it's not over the top, and you do eventually get the Velaticus, I think it's called, that lets you just fly, so you can trivialize those sections later. But it does mean that the castle itself feels quite challenging and oppressive in a way that the general getting around in the other DS Castlevanias, I think, doesn't. It's always the bosses that were the roadblock in those games, but here there are some rooms that I think are genuinely quite difficult to get through, regardless of the fact they've got enemies in them. There's traps, there's drops, there's spikes, and I like it a lot. I think it's a cool feature of the castle.
There's a lot of stuff that you get in the castle that encourages you to go back out into the world. So it's not like once you enter the castle, it's like, well, that's it for, you know, the countryside. I don't care about this anymore. You know, the first thing, obviously, is the wallman power, because there are lots of places, maybe like half a dozen notable places in the world where you're like, clearly something's happening here. There's stuff I can't reach. There's something weird happening with the wall, but I don't have this ability. So once you get that, then it's the classic Metroidvania. Ooh, I saw the place where this, you know, is a key that unlocks something. So I need to go back and find all those places again. Hopefully I was taking notes.
I wasn't.
So that sends you back traveling through the game. But also, I feel like there's just a lot of powers and, you know, glyphs that you acquire that open up new possibilities in the world that make it easier to farm enemies or find items and so on and so forth. You mentioned the glyph that lets you fly. You don't get that until the very, very end of the game. Yeah. Like, you need that to get to Dracula's room, because, you know, Castlevania has been around for so long at this point that famous stairway that Simon Belmont took to the tower room, kind of propped up on the side. I don't know what you call that. That thing's crumbled. There is no more stairway. It's like it was in more and more disrepair throughout the series, and then at this point, it's just gone. So you can't get to Dracula until you can fly, and then it's pretty much that's the game. Like, so, you know, it kind of encourages you to go back through the world and say, what can I do if I can fly? And it turns out not that much.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's still fun.
It's probably worth mentioning as well, if you don't, before you get Velaticus, there are some very recurring enemies in the sort of late game. I think they're called things like Swordmaster and Weaponmaster. These very challenging kind of mech armor things. But they throw these giant double-bladed, I don't know what they're called, but they're just big spinning blades. There's two of them.
Oh, those but things, what, yeah.
Something I learned playing through this game again for this is they've got a Magnus point on them. If you throw them and then quickly magnes, you get thrown, carried through the air by them, and you can do some interesting tricks that way. I didn't know that until very recently, but you can.
That's pretty cool.
I mean, the game is obviously designed around it, but I feel like you could get probably past those stairs doing that, if you wanted to. But I didn't try that because I didn't learn until I'd beaten the game already. I just thought, hey, that's a cool piece of tech. It's just clever. I mean, it doesn't tell you that. You should have noticed that the circle in the middle of them looks a bit like one of the magnets. And clever. There's a lot of neat touches in it, I think.
I think like the giant starfish, no, if they touched you, they poisoned you, so I didn't get too close to them. But they had like kind of an interesting center point to them, too, that they kind of emphasize when they die. So I didn't try it, but maybe next time I will. You get poisoned.
Yeah, but what would Magnusing a What are, those guys are Dekarabias, right?
Dekarabias, yeah.
Like, what would you accomplish doing that?
You'd be friends with SpongeBob.
Oh, okay. All right.
And poison.
Just more efficient poisoning?
Yeah. SpongeBob, I'm dying!
So are there any areas, I know we kind of mentioned that we don't particularly like the underground labyrinth, any areas that do stand out to you? I like that each of the areas does have its own distinct personality, and maybe the underground labyrinth is a little too big and a little too boring, but I think someone mentioned the sort of organic look of the castle entrance, where the architecture looks like nothing that's ever appeared in a Castlevania before. It was actually, you know, going back to when I was doing the mapping for this by hand, it was actually kind of challenging to figure out, like, how am I going to render some of this stuff? Because it's so fluid and so curvy and organic. Like, that's just not how Castlevania games work. But it does really kind of give you the sense of, you know, like, kind of the French high... What is that period called where it was just like they built Paris and said, let's make an entire awesome city. And they built, wow, I'm totally blanking here. The palace, the
I'm so bad at history. I wish I could help you, but I can't.
Is that Rococo, like Baroque? Rococo?
Yeah, I guess it's kind of Rococo. Why? Yeah. I've been to the palace. What the hell is it called? It's like right outside of Paris. The Sun King lived there.
I think it's called Le Palace.
Le Palace.
Yeah.
Oh God, what is wrong with my brain?
I don't know. Chinoa has never been to Paris, but she'll always have Paris.
Thank you. That's helpful.
I've been wanting to make that joke for like 10 minutes, and I'm not sure it was worth it.
You got it in there.
Anyway, yes, it's very British Rococo, like Louis the 13th, 14th. Versailles, that's it. Versailles, yes. I mean, it doesn't really look that much like Versailles. That's a little more toned down. And I don't imagine that there were lords and ladies defecating in the corners in Castlevania, but who knows?
Oh, God.
But it does just kind of give you the sense of like... This feels opulent and very grand in a way that Castlevania often doesn't. It just really felt different from the others. And then it leads to, you know, that area leads to the library, which is lots of very large, you know, high spaces where you have to have to make progress. You have to acquire the ability to, I think, do double jumps. Is that right? You can't just make it on your own. So you kind of have to go to a certain point and then say, whoops, double back. Mm-hmm. It leads to, what's the other one? Oh yeah. The barracks and the arms depot, which kind of blend together for me, even though they're not actually directly connected. Those feel like really challenging battle gauntlets, kind of narrow corridors. Barracks is a lot of skeletons with bows and arrows that hate you. And the Arms Depot is a lot of those really big guys who are basically just a wall that you have to fight through or glitch through or something. So it just all feels different and distinct.
I think I mentioned it briefly, but I do think that the sprites and the general art design go a long way to papering over any of the repetition,
or
even like the clock tower in this game. It's a clock tower again. This is like what, the eighth time they've done a clock tower,
least. But
the fact that this one's full of weird robots, you know, it helps a lot when you've got your Tin Man and your tiny little ZX. I think they call it ZX81 or something, which got me really excited as a Spectrum guy, but you know, I think that it's, I don't love all of it because, like the clock tower is full of, or sort of has a few sort of sustained journeys forward that lead to dead ends that have glyphs that you're really not going to use ever. But that's kind of an issue with all of the Castlevania games. And at least in this one, the glyphs give you build options. They're not just an item you're immediately going to discard. You will give them a go. You'll have a go with them. And they might be effective against something because of the whole focus on attributes and type, enemy types and things like that. So I think I don't think it's perfect, but I think it offers enough new that the stuff that is more repetitious doesn't jar as badly as it does in something like Portrait of Ruin, where you're doing the same area twice each, basically.
Yeah. You know, I will say that even something like the Underground Labyrinth, even though it's extremely repetitive, I feel like that is by design. It's really, I feel like it's really meant to be a gauntlet, because I'm looking at the map here. It's the biggest space in the castle by far, but it only has a single midpoint right before the Blackmoor fight. So it's one of those spaces in Castlevania, and a lot of the games have done this. I think Circle of the Moon probably did it most noticeably just because it was such a hard game.
Yeah.
But you kind of use save points as your safety space. You're like, I can venture out from here and explore the unknown, but I'm going to take a beating and it's going to be challenging. So I need to, you know, be able to haul ass back there. And when the save spaces are too close together, which I think was a problem in Portrait of Ruin, especially, it takes away that sense of danger. It takes away like the sense of, you know, how do you create danger in a game where you can have so many hit points and so many weapons and so many powers and so on and so forth? Like, how do you create a sense of the same fragility that you had in the early like NES Castlevanias? Well, a way you do that is to minimize the number of opportunities that a player has to save their data, to restore their life, and to really force them to push out and put themselves at risk to like go a little beyond what they necessarily have, you know, where they necessarily feel comfortable in terms of their energy and their potions and things like that, to try to find another exit and try to find another save point and so on and so forth. And I feel like the Underground Labyrinth really takes that to probably the biggest extreme we've seen since Circle of the Moon.
Almost all the other bosses in this game, besides Blackmoor, have save points either right next to them or one small doorway away from them. And that, he is the only one where there is a save point reasonably near him, but if you haven't found it, which I had a lot of problem doing when I played it, because it's then that is very much, I completely agree, it's meant to be daunting and imposing, and that design, the more drab nature of it compared to the rest of the castle, does definitely feed into that. So I do agree.
Yeah, the Blackmoor has a save point pretty close to him, but also a warp point. Yeah. And you don't actually find in the castle the warp and save points that close together that often.
Yeah.
So the fact that they've structured it like this, and they do this right before death also, it really tells me that they knew you would get to Blackmoor, and Blackmoor would demolish you, just kick your ass up and down. You're gone, toast. And you would say, I'm not ready for this, and warp out to go build up your attributes or find other glyphs or grind some potions or something. So again, it feels very deliberate. And you know, by pushing through the Underground Labyrinth, you do get quite a few rewards. There's some really good glyphs in there. And also there's the hidden exit to the world map, which takes you and unlocks the challenge room. And then also it takes you up to the barracks and allows you to advance through the game. I feel like it's really thoughtfully designed, and it's one of those occurrences where it feels kind of unhappy when you're playing it, but it does serve a purpose, which is like, you know, kind of the gloves are off here. And, you know, Blackmoor is a wall. And if you can beat Blackmoor, well, then you still have to be able to push your way through the rest of the Underground Labyrinth. So it kind of feels like, you know, this is your big test before you can enter the true final stretch of the game. So, you know, I enjoyed on that level.
In terms of memorable areas for their aesthetics, one that stuck with me because it felt like a missed opportunity was the area that's like the library where there's like platforms that are just like stacks of books.
Yeah, I love that.
And like if you jump on them, like there's little papers that fly out or whatever. And because really of satisfying. That weird bit of interaction there, it feels like a place where you should be afraid to use like fire weapons. But if you do, nothing happens. And it's like, well, come on. You couldn't make one area where it's like, no, don't use that here. Bad things happen.
That would have been cool.
Yeah, that might just be asking a little too much of a ragtag little game design team.
That's true. Because then, like, another thing I was disappointed about was, you know, like, it's nothing new here, but the idea that, you know, you're loading up your inventory with just, like, countless little pieces of equipment that have these names that are very visual. Like you can imagine the character wearing them, but every time you put on like a different outfit, your character looks the same. And it's like, it would be so nice if your character actually looked like this, but you know.
Yeah.
Created so many sprites for Shanoa. I am not going to hold it against them for not going the extra mile and doubling that number, tripling, who knows.
I do think it's a rare thrill whenever you do play a game where the equipment that you put on your character is reflected on the character. It's always just like, yes!
Yeah. It always adds a little bit of personality.
Yeah.
I think my main or only major visual problem with this game, besides the aforementioned, you know, problems with the levels being copies at points, is the NPCs. I was trying to figure it out. Okay, what are they reminding me of, these faces? And they all just remind me of, like, Cabbage Patch Dolls with the mumps. And just kind of like change the hair, and that's your NPCs, and they're just kind of all creepy looking, but that's a very minor thing. Kind of endearing in a way.
Are you talking about their character portraits?
Yeah, you know, like when you talk to a character and they say, "Hi, I'm so-and-so, thanks for rescuing me." And in a lot of cases, they all have the same face, which looks like a Cabbage Patch doll with the terrible inflammation on his face. I mean, it's, it's just...
Are we talking about the same game here?
Yeah, all the portraits look weird. Except for, like, Shanoa and Albus, like, they all look fine, but the, like, NPCs that you rescue in town, I don't know, they all just look very strange to me, especially Order of Ecclesia dude. Well, I'm surprised that he looks kind of sinister, but whatever.
You look, I have to look at those again.
It could be my overactive imagination attaching weird metaphors to things.
I kind of see it. I don't see it in all of them, but I can sort of see what you mean.
Kind of bloated, right? Puffy-faced.
There is a puffiness to them for sure. Yeah, yeah, it's definitely there. It's not on all of them, but it's there. I'm not sure. I think that this might be an Eye of the Beholder type situation.
Oh, though. Probably. No,
yeah. Like to me, Barlow just looks like, you know, his buccal fat has withered away with age, so he's a little.
This is gonna be one of those instances.
In the cheeks, there is definitely a
right.
That's there. But maybe I'm not seeing it to quite the same extent.
No, I just see horrifying things in character portraits sometimes.
I don't like Serge. I hate him.
Serge, which one's Serge?
Is this child who just looks properly evil? For all I know, he probably is evil. It's probably. Castlevania, you know, everyone's evil. But
oh, yeah, I'm looking. He's got kind of a Children of the Corn thing.
I think he's the one who's like, oh, play hide and seek with me, and then he just vanishes.
Oh, that jerk,
and it's like, what are you doing? Like, how are you doing this?
And I ran out of time. He's like, oh, you could do better than that. And I said, no, I can't.
Yeah,
and, just
and he's
him.
Like hiding in a barrel that you smash open with a massive scythe, and he's like, oh, you found me.
Oh, yeah. You found me. I'm trying to kill you. Oh, darn, you're okay.
Yeah, he looks like he was originally meant to host, like, the spirit of Dracula or something.
Yeah.
Even Dracula was like, I ain't screwing with this kid. No, sir, how.
He fears the surge of power.
Hey! Okay, anyway, so we need to, you know, give some time over to the Discord community. So I will ask you for your final thoughts on Castlevania Order of Ecclesia. Also, did any of you play Albus mode?
Oh, I did. Yes, it was.
Yes, I did not.
Tell us about it. What do you think?
It's for even like for a bonus mode in a Castlevania game, it does feel a bit half-assed. It's in the sense that they didn't change anything. There's no new story at all. Not even like a line of dialogue. And you know, at the end, Albus fights himself. And it's just Albus versus Albus with no sort of explanation whatsoever.
It's one of the classic literary forms, man versus self.
Yeah. That is true, yeah. And I mean, yes, it's a bonus mode, I get that. But I think he's fun to play as because he does have an interesting suite of skills. I mean, he can use his attacks from the boss fight with him. There's something always satisfying about just unloading with essentially a hit scan, like rapid multiple auto pistol into a Dracula. Just like, no, I'm not fighting you. Get out of here. Bam, bam, bam. But, I did enjoy it. Some of the bosses are hell as him. I found Bracura incredibly difficult with Albus because he takes so few hits. And he has attacks that shoot downwards, but not to the reliable, like, Shinoa way. But the rest of it was more or less fine until I got to Dracula, which was horrible, but I got there in the end.
Wow. Dracula was so you really went difficult. For it.
Well, I wanted to get all of 100% of the achievements in the Dominus collection, because I never do that, but they're almost all very achievable, I thought, in this game. There weren't any really ridiculous ones like get every single item drop in like Dawn of Sorrow or something. That's not happening. But, yeah, I wanted to get all of them, which I did do, which makes me, I guess it makes me a really impressive and brave boy.
It does. It does.
Thank you.
I concur.
I was very brave. Thank you, Nadia. but Albus mode, I do like the fact that he can teleport around by tapping the screen. That's fun and also necessary in places. So when I forgot you could do that, I was walking around going, how the hell do I get any further in the game?
Can you use that to zap on the other side of Blackmore?
I don't think so. I think he pretty much takes up the entire right side of the screen.
I tried to go behind Blackmore like in several ways and it just can't happen.
But it is a very fun way of avoiding certain attacks, like when Dracula is doing his some of his more ridiculous attacks, you can just kind of zap behind him and laugh, which it's always fun. It's a fun thing to do. But compared to something like, you know, obviously the frontrunner Julius mode in Dawn of Sorrow, or even Richter and Maria mode in Portrait of Ruin, which is fun as well, it does feel a little bit like... It's a shame because the rest of the game doesn't feel half-assed. It feels very arsed indeed. So it feels it is a shame in that respect because you'd think even just the tiniest bit of dialogue or even just like Albus is recovering his memories or something in the form of this, you know, he's recovering from whatever and he's facing himself. That would be cool, but you don't get anything. So it really does just feel like, yeah, we threw this in. But that is also being maybe too mean about it because it is fun. I think I'm just trapped in a circle of saying the same things about it now, so I'm just going to stop talking. It's good. I liked it.
A plus.
So I want to talk about
Albus.
The story aspect of the ending, if that's all right. So I was kind of excited for the ending after like the midpoint twist where, you know, you have to like rescue all of the villagers or whatever to get like past the bad ending. Right. Like,
yeah,
that felt clever and new. And I was like, what's going to be clever and new about the ending? And instead, the ending is just first of all, it's the predictable thing of, oh, the thing that you were told to never, ever use.
Yeah.
Predictably, you have to use that to finish it. And then once you beat the boss and you get to the ending aspect, it turns out the whole theme of the game amounts to, you know, Shinoa, you'd look prettier if you smiled more. And it's not only Albus like doing that as the ending, but then there's that one villager who like her whole quest isn't it about like, I want to make you something so special that you smile finally. It's like, why is that the theme? Like, you know, I have issues with the, treatment of the main character, because I love her character design and I love her power set, you know. But then I don't like that they, at the beginning of the game, they cook her brain so thoroughly that it's like astonishing that she knows how to speak or walk, you know, like she's just like obliterated. So you spend this whole game as somebody who like knows so little about
all
herself.
She knows is killing.
Right. Indeed. And then you get to the end of the game, and instead of like being some like meaty reveal about her identity that helps you get to know her, it's like smile.
Smile. Don't smile because it's over, smile because it happened.
I mean, that's how Roger Rabbit ended too. All those guys came out and saying, smile, darn you, smile. So, you know, it's just endemic to something.
To something. But
yes,
something cheerful.
Point taken. They don't give a lot of good characterization, although to be honest, that's not really Castlevania's forte. So it's probably just kind of working in a shallow pool to begin with.
Yeah. I do agree with you. I do like the ending in the respect that it has an emotional hook, though it is obviously quite a contrived one. Mm-hmm. And it is quite sweet in the end. It's like, oh yeah, you've got your sort of emotions back, even though again, bit of a sort of ass pull. It's a story with a lot of just loss happening sort of one off the other. And it doesn't have a particularly grandly happy ending. You know, Albus is still, mincemeat. And Dracula's going to be back. You know
what? Spoilers.
Hey, he hasn't come back yet because they haven't made another one of these games.
That's true. When I saw
they killed
end
him for good.
Yeah. And the ending, I thought, oh yeah, you don't know the half of it, dude.
Yeah, I'm just saying, like, oh, don't worry. When we get the Battle of 1999 game, that'll be there. And I'm still waiting.
It'll happen. I'm keeping the faith.
Kickstarter, right?
So anyway, final thoughts on Castlevania: Order of Ecclesia.
Well, Jeremy, I like it. I think it's good.
Yeah.
Well done, Stuart.
That was more or less what I'm going to echo. It's not my favorite Castlevania by a long shot, but I'm kind of sad that it's over because it could have been an interesting place to lead from.
I can't wait to compare this to the other ones because, you know, everyone's saying this is the hardest one, and it's like, oh, that's a relief, because I thought I was going to hate all of them now.
No. Portrait of Ruin, you can just kind of take a nap and just sort of sleepwalk your way through.
Yeah, it rules.
So my final thoughts, I regret having waited so long to actually get into this game and letting the really striking difference in how you have to approach combat push me away, because it's a really good Castlevania game. On the other hand, by not having played it until 2024, I got to play a new Castlevania game in 2024, and that was very satisfying. So, you know, I was kind of 15 years late to the party, but it all worked out for me. And I do have issues with this game. You know, like I really wish, like I said a lot last episode, that they had the courage to keep the world interconnected the way they intended, clearly, when they sat down and designed everything. I think that would make for a much more just fulfilling experience, much more of a, like, you are in this land and you have to find your way through. But okay, it happens. I wish that it weren't quite so dependent on random number generators and finding the right tool and hoping enemies give these things to you. I feel like it's really, they really padded the gameplay, the game time, with a lot of randomization, which I don't love. But, you know, it was the first time they had really tried something like that with a Castlevania game. Up until this point, I would say, like, finding all the hard to, you know, the rare random drops were pretty much, that was kind of an optional element. Whereas here, it's mandatory. And I think it needed a little more time in the oven. But, you know, despite those complaints, it's a beautiful game, phenomenal music. It feels good once you acquire a few powers beyond the basic glyphs. It's very satisfying to play. Like, Shanoa is not too fast, but also not too slow and cumbersome. She has that good kind of mid-range speed that brings it back a bit from Portrait of Ruin and Dawn of Sorrow. Yeah, it just has a real sense of solidity to it. And I love the castle. The castle's great. So, all in all, I would say upper quartile of Castlevania.
I think for me, while I do enjoy this game very much, it has a similar problem to something like, in terms of excellent games, something like Yoshi's Island to me, which again, wonderful
game. It's just too awesome.
Well, no, it's that it lacks any kind of breeziness whatsoever. It's difficult from the beginning. It's a slog from the start. It's killing you a lot. And it's like, I won't come back and play this one as often as I would play something like Portrait of Ruin, which, as you say, you can breeze through, because I kind of value being able to breeze through things when I replay games. And the comparison with Yoshi's Island being, when I play that game and I want to full clear it, I'm going to be spending 20 minutes in each stage, which puts me off playing it. So I just go and play Mario 3 instead. And that's kind of what I do here. I think it's a great game. And I think I don't like using this word objectively because it's nonsense, but speaking as a critic, I think it's the better game than Portrait of Ruin. It's a better structured game. It's a much more unique game. And it's a lot less reliant on fan service than Portrait of Ruin. But I like Portrait of Ruin for replays because you can do the whole thing in about 6 hours. Full clear it, see a lot of really, really cool stuff, and then just be done with it. And order by that point, I would still probably not have got to the castle yet. So,
yeah.
And that is, I do value that, unfortunately.
Well, I guess that wraps it up for Castlevania Order of Ecclesia. There is still the matter of Discord feedback, so we should tackle that. Do all of you have your show notes open?
Yes.
So that we can take turns voicing different people's opinions?
Yes.
And should we announce the next game that we're going to tackle now? Or should we wait until after we're done with this? Maybe when we're done.
At the end,
yeah,
so everyone goes home with a nice little teaser. Marvel style.
It's like a gift bag.
Yeah.
All right. So as announced in the last episode, we really wanted people to play along and experience this game and comment on it for themselves. And lots of people stepped up and I would say had a great time. Dozens of people chimed in on this on Discord and left some great, chewy, thoughtful feedback. And so I appreciate everyone who took part in this. It was interesting to read and to participate in. So thanks for making this successful and not saying, what a dumb idea, Jeremy Parrish. Don't ever do this again. I always appreciate not being made to look like a fool in public. So we are going to take turns reading some of the comments, some of the beefier comments. If you are vegetarian, some of the, fluffier comments.
Tofu-ier.
The more tofu-laden protein comments. So let's see. I'm going to actually skip the first comment section that I copy and pasted because it was someone who commented without having listened to the episode or played. Yeah, don't do that, folks. Listen to the episode first and then share your thoughts on what we're going to say, or what we did say, rather than what you think we're going to say.
We get your enthusiastic. All right, so
a little scolding aside, let's jump ahead to what John Learned said. You guys kind of joked on the show about this and the Souls games, but I've said for years that this absolutely is the proto-Souls. Ecclesia and Demon's Souls share so much structurally that it's kind of nuts to me that there isn't any overlap in staff. From the smaller levels, to the weapon affinities, to the hub that you expand by finding NPCs and doing often obtuse quests for them, the only thing it really lacks in comparison is stat allocation. I often tell people that play this for the first time that if you've played a Souls game before, the magic meter is your stamina. I played this when it was brand new, when I used to travel for work, so I was stuck in a hotel room for days on end with nothing to do but force my way through. I replayed it about 9 years ago in a post-Dark Souls world, and with that mentality, the game made perfect sense to me, even though I liked it right from the start. So yeah. Do we have feelings about this from soft sickos?
I'm not a sicko, but I definitely understand the comparison. It's definitely about memorizing those patterns, finding the right tools for the weapons. But no stat allocation, as was pointed out.
I do agree. And when you were talking about the underground labyrinth and the distance between the save points and the save points being, you know, your safe point, that made me think, yeah, it's like in a Souls game when you think, can I make it to the bonfire or should I go back and retain what I've got here and not lose this? And this game does capture that. And it hadn't occurred to me until just now, the green stamina bar, the green magic bar, it really is almost identical.
Yeah.
Okay.
What order are we going in?
What's that? I see what you're saying. Stuart, you go next.
Okay. They got a comment from Periphera here. The first comment from Periphera, haven't been alluded to already, don't worry, saying, I didn't like it at first, but it grew on me in a big way. Shinoa is probably the best feeling protagonist since Alucard, like everyone was mentioning about her beautifully animated hair and stuff, gives her a distinct sense of physicality. She's also pretty clearly an iteration on what they were doing with Charlotte.
And then what they would do with Miriam.
Yeah. Yeah, good point.
So she's like a midpoint.
Yeah, it is. Like, her animation is gorgeous. Like, it is nice to have characters with long hair just so you can kind of get that, you know, just dig that pixel-based animation for the hair. Love me some Belmonts, but they're a little bit lacking in the hair physics department. Not Alucard, though. He's king.
Yeah, you know, even in the Castlevania remake of the X68000 game, they gave Simon Belmont like crazy long hair and, you know, like a feather boa. And then there's not that much wild animation on those things.
Right.
I feel like it's a missed opportunity.
Why do that if you're not going to have fun with it?
Exactly. Kate, thoughts?
Well, I don't know who Charlotte is. I saw. Oh,
that's right. You haven't played Portrait of Ruin yet. Spoilers. Okay. Well, in that case, would you like to tackle Guillermo J's comments here?
Guillermo J says, aside, Albus was the only boss in the game that I managed to beat without taking damage, mostly because I lost to him so many times in my only playthrough of the game that by the time I did beat him, I'd virtually memorized his moves and how to counter them. The giant centaur mech was absolutely the toughest fight in the game, maybe in all of Castlevania. It took me several tries, and when I finally beat him, I'd spent most of my heavy-hitting items and magic and all of my extra health potions and was last to my last sliver of health.
Yeah, it's definitely one of those fights where you start to sweat a little bit.
Yeah, Aragorn hits you really hard, especially once you're up on his back and going after the giant eyeball in the back of his skull. So there's not a lot of room for error there.
He doesn't appreciate being poked in the eyeball very much.
No, I mean, whomst among us.
Whomst indeed.
I mean, you know that trick I mentioned earlier about throwing the arcing blades and then magnes to them to fling you in the air?
Yeah.
You can use that to just get straight up on his back and spam all of your glyph unions.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, I was so angry when I saw that because I'd spent so many times fighting him across three or four playthroughs without knowing that I had to go under his stupid-ass horse legs over and over again.
Stupid-ass horse.
Yeah.
Is he an ass or a horse?
All the bosses are pretty tough for me. I really liked the design of this character, though.
It was like,
oh, yeah, it's very cool.
Yeah.
And who wouldn't want to have crossbows for knees?
It's true. Although it makes, you know, sitting with your knees crossed very, very fraught. Do not recommend.
It does also make you bow-legged.
Hey!
I'm sorry. I can't stop doing shit jokes. Please forgive me.
Wait a minute. I've got a reaction for Stuart. Oh, it's not in focus.
No, I can see what it is. Don't worry. I can see what it is.
Yeah. Someone gave me a Charlie Brown pillow that just says good grief. It's a very appropriate.
That's a mood,
sometimes.
Isn't it?
Yeah, it is. So Nadia, I want to read Galbana's comments.
Sure. Galbana writes, "The villager system is a neat idea and one that really defines this entry for me personally. I love the idea of connecting with people in a story about lost emotions, but I think it could have been done better with more variety in quests and level design. It did motivate exploring slightly more open areas in the middle and later portion of the game, and I think it could have been about something more special if they just had time to cook. After all, cooking's about heart. Just kidding. It's true, though. Cooking is all about heart, and not paying attention to the instructions."
Yeah, the quests were something that they experimented with originally in Portrait of Ruin, but Wynn's quests felt really like, why am I doing this?
Yeah, whereas completely detached from the narrative.
Yeah, whereas these feel pretty essential because basically any good armor and items that you hope to acquire, you know, outside of finding glyphs or lucking into something in the castle, they're going to come from the quests. So
finding gold ore was very hard in this game. That was one quest you had to do to get, I'm assuming, some of the best armor in the game, but I just, those drops from the Tin Man are not very frequent.
There's one quest that requires you to beat the training hall, and it's not even guaranteed that you'll get it at the end of it. It's like a random drop from the chest, and I'm like, nope.
No, thank you.
Yeah, so they could have balanced it to be a little more fun and a little less like keep grinding. But on the whole, again, it feels like the midpoint between Portrait of Ruin and Bloodstained. So, you know, it's kind of working through some ideas, expanding them, not quite getting them right, but teeing themselves up for success once they realized that they didn't want to be janitors at Konami and went independent.
Man, I am sadness at that line.
All right, from Scott. Amazing game, despite its many missteps, of which I can't fault them for trying new things. But I still wish it was a single contiguous map with a larger amount of unique layouts. I love the concept of missions, of item unlocks, but the drop rates, my God, the drop rates. Love having to change up items, but the inventory management is a nightmare. Lots of I really like X, but why hold it back? Take some bold steps, some misses. Overall vibes will get you past the low points.
I agree about the inventory, but the reason... Yeah. I mean, the thing is they cut back on the clutter in terms of how many items you get, like in the previous games. But the problem is all the items are named things like Volthalgir or Volmascius. And I'm like, what is that? Which one is that?
I want an axe. Give me an axe, please.
I mean, if you have... If you know some Latin, it's helpful.
You can fake it.
Yeah.
But you gotta like shuffle through it and remember, like, okay, this vaguely looks like the word axe. I'm guessing this is what I need.
Yeah, I feel like expecting someone to have taken Latin class is kind of a big ask. Yes. I'm the weirdo who actually did take Latin class, so.
Oh, so did I, but I didn't retain any of it or remember or pay attention.
There you go. I remember ego sum papo magnus et rotundus.
I remember.
I think therefore I am. Is that the one?
No, it's I'm a pumpkin big and round.
Good grief.
Close enough.
Anyway, yeah.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of how many different similar items there were and all this stat stuff, both in terms of like armor and in terms of weapons. It just felt like there's so many things that you're gonna maybe use just very briefly until you find the next cool thing. If you use it at all, like half your inventory is going to be things that you never use because it doesn't even seem better than what you currently have. It's just like, what is there anyone who actually enjoys like just collecting all the stuff and comparing the stats? Like, is there fun in that, or why not just scale it back? And
it depends. Sometimes, yes. Oddly enough, in Portrait of Ruin, I did enjoy collecting all the things, but the reason I did is because it really was just such brain mush, easy brain off, back and forth through the rooms, hitting the enemies, and it's so easy to kill them that it almost becomes sort of metronomic. It's grinding done in a way that I appreciate, whereas here, getting the rare items requires you to open chests, which will have, maybe have the item in, and the chests don't reappear unless you hit certain conditions, and they sometimes at the end of quite difficult gauntlets, which was more frustrating, I thought. But there was less of it to balance it out.
I think the game really wants you to, I know the game really wants you to juggle your glyphs so that you're focusing on affinities and trying to use, you know, the glyphs that have the attack type that's most effective against the current enemies. And I guess that kind of works, but mostly in the beginning of the game, because after a while you start to collect glyphs that, you know, you'll get like one high-end glyph in a certain category, and even without the affinity bonuses, it's still so much more powerful than using the correct, quote-unquote, correct weapon that you don't have a higher class of glyph for, that it's like, why would I switch back over? And it also doesn't help that each of the categories levels up as you use glyphs of that type. So there's a real, you know, there's something to be said for focusing on like two or three different types of categories of glyph and trying to, you know, boost those just through use. So it's kind of got the Final Fantasy II saga problem going on.
I had an owl familiar that just could not level up, and I sat there like collecting souls for it, and it just never happened.
Owls are actually very stupid. That's the problem.
That's true. That's the problem. They forgot to level up because they're just that dumb.
I think one very small change that I personally would have made, not that I'm a game designer, but any metric, I think maybe when you get the upgraded versions of the glyphs, I would have had them just replace the old ones in the menu. Because you're never going to use like Meskis when you've got Volmeskis or like the one even bigger than that. I guess maybe there is some stat reason, like maybe they use less magic, but you're still not going to use them because they're not going to do jack to the later game.
And you can dual wield pretty much anything, so there's no reason to.
Or even let you maybe hide them in the menu if you're never going to use them, something like that. But that's maybe beyond the DS, like in terms of this team. I don't know. Maybe
that's I don't think that kind of user interface design was necessarily in vogue at that point. I mean, this did come out a year after, like 6 months after Mass Effect, and sweet Jesus, that menu with all the clutter.
Oh,
like,
my God.
This was, you know, the Ecclesia was not the only sinner in this congregation.
It's a bit of a side effect of being, having so much build quality, because while they did pare back the items massively from the other games, in the previous games, you get a good item and you never use anything again apart from them. You just keep leveling up, you get one up better item.
Yeah,
but here you will need to keep switching, which means you'll be in the inventory more, playing around with the things more, which then makes it seem like there are maybe like more of them. There's more to juggle, but really, it's a bit of an illusion, but it's still something you have to deal with.
I think the best middle ground would be like simplifying so that there aren't so many. Like, well, so the shortest version of what I'm thinking for a middle ground would be like, I don't like that there are so many things that are like, this is the correct one to use. I think it would be cooler if they had this variety. You know, I like the simplification of Metroid, but if they want to make it like less simple, where there are like additional options, make it so that it's options that are, you get to choose what is most fun for your personal play style rather than what is correct, right? So like maybe you prefer ranged, maybe you prefer to get up and melee, you know, like that kind of like options, that there's no correct answer, but it's just like whatever's the most fun for you, however you want to play it, right?
I wonder if maybe instead of having the incorrect element do one damage to the enemy, have it do normal damage and the correct element do much more damage or something, and rebalance it that way so that you can still use the other ones if you want to, but you are going to be at a disadvantage, just not a complete, like, just not nothing, you know? Something. You can still beat the enemy, but it's a lot tougher.
No, it's a video game. It's supposed to punish you and be harrowing if you don't use your free time exactly the way they want.
Mm.
Anyway, why don't we jump on and head to the next comment from Cormacor?
Cormacor, I think it's my turn, isn't it? Oh, good. This one's really short. Thank you, Jeremy. Cormacor says, the fact that most of the game consists of discrete levels with rather linear progression did have the effect of really making me relish when I was let loose on Dracula's castle with all my abilities and glyphs, made the final stretch feel pretty cool. Yeah, I agree with that. It's a nice reveal. It's like, oh, there is a castle. Let's go.
Yeah, it definitely does let you kind of let loose a little bit when the castle is revealed, especially since that's where I found the cat ability that just let me go completely wild, so to speak. You just kind of get to that point, and it takes a little bit of time, and that might...
You really like that cat glyph.
It's really good, and it's a lot of fun. Like, I mean, we're not going to talk about how kind of kinky they made it, but it's still a lot of fun to use. Like, it uses very little magic. And your regular slice takes off a chunk of magic, a chunk of health, plus it restores your health by one for every hit you do, including on the candelabras and whatnot. And you just have this, like, completely psycho, like, X button attack where you just slash the air repeatedly for, like, zero magic cost. And it's just absolutely crazy. I love it.
I think they brought that back for Ritual of the Night Bloodstained as well.
Good.
Which was cool, yeah. It's interesting because you're playing it and you're like, oh, I'm like, perhaps disappointed. This isn't quite as horny as the other Castlevania games. Oh, there it is.
Yeah, exactly. What was extra funny to me is that the cat and the bat both have that kind of cheesecake vibe. And then when you get the metal guy, the metal power up, it's like there's robots that are a lot like taller, and you could imagine her like the sexy version of that, and instead Metropolis. It's just like
Metropolis.
Instead it's like tin cans. So you have like bat, cat, and then you're like, oh, what's this gonna be? And it's just like garbage can.
R2-D2 maybe for some people that is.
Yeah.
Kate, want to jump on the next comment?
Let's see. Niles Gotta Have It says, I enjoyed this game, but did I read that correctly?
Oh, yes. I was just expressing consternation with that username. Sorry.
Okay. I enjoyed this game, but I don't feel like it is much of a Metroidvania, honestly. I think this is because progression mostly consisted of going left to right or vice versa, and very rarely did I encounter an obstacle that I had to come back to after acquiring a new skill. I also didn't feel particularly rewarded for backtracking. The only moment that stuck out to me were the high ledges on Oblivion Ridge and going back after getting the Mercury boots. It seemed like most useful items were gated by helping villagers or were hidden behind walls. I guess the series was moving beyond this, but I miss having one unified map versus small segmented spaces.
I don't disagree with that, but I'm wondering if this person got to the castle, because not only is that, you know, a unified space, but also once you get the wallman power, there's a lot of stuff in the game, the overworld, that you need to go back and find.
Yeah, there's that room you need to, well, it's not, you don't need to, but you can use your electric glyph to power a couple of generators that opens up a shutter behind you to reveal another secret. There's a few things like that.
Yeah, there's some neat little tricks like that.
Yeah. So it's there. It is there. I think that they're right. I think that the progression through this game is a lot more straightforward than in the previous ones in that respect. But I was kind of happy for the change in focus, change in style. So it works for me. And it's still a Metroidvania. I think it ticks all the classic boxes of the Metroidvania. It doesn't succumb to items that really are just lock and key. They don't really have any use outside of that. And there's a lot of build variety and little tricks that you can use to sequence break if you want to some extent. So it is there, but I think they make you work for it a little bit more, or don't maybe make it quite so front loaded for the sake of accessibility. Which is a weird thing to say about a game as difficult as this, but there it is.
I just want to say that, you got me wondering now if the name is some reference that's over my head. The username. Well,
Niles, I guess Niles needs love too. It can't just be Frasier, you know?
Who doesn't?
I don't.
Nadia, this next one is actually kind of a reaction to the previous comment.
And there's your elf reference, Jeremy.
I know, it's haunting me today.
So this is from He's Back in Pog form. I actually didn't mind that it's not one big map. For me, the bigger problem is that so far, some of the levels are just uninteresting level design. Unless I'm missing something from not having backtracked yet, the smaller levels are just forgettable. Ruvas Forest is just a straight line. Skeleton Cave is just straight lines on top of each other. I don't think those levels would have been more interesting if they were just integrated into one map. Yeah, I see where they're coming from with this. We've talked at length about the kind of repeated levels. I do find it a little bit, like, maybe jarring how you go into a level kind of expecting something bigger, and sometimes you get it, but also sometimes you get a straight line, like they said here, which... one thing I am very grateful for with this game is that if there's, like, multiple entrances in a level, you will see a map of the level before you enter, and you can kind of enter from different points, and that really helps with the backtracking, I find. But, yeah, it definitely feels more piecemeal, I suppose is the word, versus, you know, a big castle by design, but... whether you like that or don't is up to you.
See, I think I said this last episode, but I feel like having the overworld compiled into a single interconnected space would make things like Ruvas Forest feel less meaningless because they would be conduits that connect you between other spaces, as opposed to like, hey, you stepped off the world map. Now here's three screens. Okay, that you're done. Good job. They just feel inconsequential when they're broken like this, but as kind of like a straightforward connection between much bigger, more complex spaces, I feel like they would work better.
Oh. Yeah, maybe I love the kind of fast travel aspect of the things, but maybe they should have made it more of like function like fast travel, where you only see that map if you activate the thing. So that you could actually just go directly to the next space instead of always just automatically being taken to a map that makes it all feel like little things.
Well, I guess there is no point in debating it because they made the game that they made. Well,
they sure did.
So this one is from Jeff Bar BD Jeffy P. I really enjoy this game over almost all of the Igavanias. Aria of Sorrow is still my favorite overall, and I haven't played Portrait of Ruin yet to make a comparison to that. The risk-reward that comes into play when a glyph appears can be both exciting and frustrating, since obtaining a glyph takes time, and the glyph can disappear if you don't attempt to hoover it.
Yes.
Other enemies still nearby become a huge hazard while you're vulnerable. It's definitely frustrating if a rare glyph appears and you're trying to handle the riffraff at the same time, but so satisfying when you're able to handle the enemies and still get the glyph. I know I've made some comments about room repetition, but I did also notice that there are some fine details with the placement of decorations in those duplications, in those duplicates, especially in Dracula's castle. So there were definitely attempts to make variation with the rubber stamping. However, unique rooms are very unique and breathtaking with their vistas and settings. Standouts include the stairway room to Dracula's throne, the lighthouse elevator shaft, and the sunken ship. Most of the difficulty is not the bosses, sorry Kate, once you learn their patterns. The main difficulty is survival and traversing the rooms between save points and warp rooms that get you near an exit to be able to heal up at the village. Common enemies hit hard, and even gaining levels and equipment doesn't do much to mitigate that. You are a paper tiger glass cannon throughout the whole game. I can see how people used to the early Igavanias may bounce off of this.
Magical tickets, they're very cheap. Buy them. You can walk to the village from anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
A trick one should have learned in Castlevania Symphony of the Night.
Yes.
Unless, like Kate, they have not played Castlevania Symphony of the Night.
In which case,
now you can backport that wisdom gained from this experience into that game and approach it like a pro.
I want to play Symphony of the Night for the first time again.
Right?
Yeah. Oh, man.
Go on, then.
I should clarify that I have played Symphony of the Night. I just haven't played all of it.
Oh, okay. You'll get there.
Wow. I've never heard of anyone giving up on Symphony of the Night partway through.
Well, it wasn't like I gave up because I bounced off of it. It was more like getting distracted with other things and then coming back to it and like, where am I? Maybe I should just...
That's the problem with Creatures of Chaos. Nadia knows chaotic. All about that.
Hell yeah.
Stuart, want to jump in here with Zerathion?
Zerathion says, beat Crab last night. This needs to be about Castlevania, Zerathion. Sorry, I'll start over. Beat Crab last night. Funny, he was hard until he wasn't. Oh, God damn it. Once I learned to dodge his dumb motion queen to the left, I had plenty of health to get to the end. Then I got to the Gravediggers, the Undertaker. Kind of feels like this is where the game is finally ramping up the difficulty on the normal enemies. Dealing with them and all the ghosts was enough to call it quits and head to bed for the evening. It's nice having more elemental glyphs now, figuring out synergies with element plus weapon as opposed to just doubling up the same weapon for DPS. It's all in the build variety.
I have to call out, just while it's on my mind, there is a Gravekeeper sprite swap, the Invisible Man, which I think is brilliant because, like, he has a cloak on or a hat and a coat, and then he just drops them. So you're fighting an invisible naked man, but you don't know because he's invisible. And then he fills with blood when you kill him and explodes. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, there is something that feels a little icky about fighting a naked dude. Like, it's one thing to have naked monsters because they're just like monsters, you know, like a werewolf running around, you know, okay, whatever. He's bestial. But this guy, like, he's clothed and then he takes off his clothes and that just changes. He's not naked, he's naked.
Yeah.
That means you're up to something.
Yeah.
It feels, it's a little uncomfortable. So anytime one of those guys showed up, I was like, please get away. Shinoa does not want anything to do with you.
He just like goes, I'm like, oh God, it's a naked screaming man who's invisible. Just what I need.
You wouldn't even have to attack me. I'd still feel kind of uncomfortable if he was
right?
there. Yeah.
Yeah, I'd be like, flashed, but I can't call you out because you're invisible, you asshole.
All right. Kate, want to jump ahead to Sparkles 24?
Let's see. Sparkles 24 says, I remember destroying my DS in frustration playing this game the first time.
Wow.
I did eventually finish it and haven't gone back to it until the Dominus collection. I still like Bloodstained better than this game. It's a fuller realized game. Portrait and this game reusing level assets really bothered me at the time. The Iga Castlevania peaked IMO with Aria of Sorrow and still the best just under Symphony of the Night, Dawn of Sorrow.
Yikes.
Hot take, Stuart?
Oh no, sorry. I'm just not used to being nice to the listeners from this month in Retronauts. That's all. I like making fun of them. It's good, but that's for me. That's like the opposite of the correct order. But hey, you got to do you. You know, each to their own.
Oh, I loved Area of Sorrow.
Oh, I love Area of Sorrow. It's just that saying that Dawn of Sorrow is the second best is like
I'm not.
I really am not sure about that one.
Yeah.
But, you know, each to their own. I think a lot of it comes from which was the first one that you played, like, new, absolutely. Maybe.
Yeah.
But then again, they may not have. I may be making an assumption here. And they're all lovely games. Don't almost destroy your DSN frustration, though, you know. If you want to destroy your DSN frustration, play Trauma Center. I mean, that's the one, though.
Yeah.
I never played that. Is it very frustrating?
Yeah. Yes. Yes, it is.
It's a game that hates you.
God, I remember making fun of it back on the Talking Time forums.
It's great. It's really, really fun, but it's incredibly frustrating.
I had to dip out of reviewing that one for 1UP because I did most of my review play on the train or the bus on the way to work, and trying to play that game that requires such pixel precision and speed with your stylus in a moving vehicle, a moving mass transit vehicle, was actually impossible. So I had to hand it off to someone else.
That's what surgeons do when they're doing hard mode on their job.
Open heart surgery on the Muni.
On the bus. Yeah.
The irony is trying to do the Tri-Tie virus and drawing those tiny triangles over and over and over again at high speed gave me such bad RSI that I actually had to go to a trauma center.
And explain what happened? I played
video too
hard.
It's all psyops.
No, it was too embarrassing, so I told them I got it masturbating instead.
That's far less humiliating, I understand.
Yeah.
That's like a 90s Sega ad right there.
Oh, God.
It actually is, yeah.
Okay, let's jump down ahead to, let's see, the final thoughts from yesterday, posted yesterday. Okay, starting with Zarathion again, yesterday at 10:53 p.m. So who's up next? I think Kate?
I think I am.
Oh, Nadia?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They say, I'm still working my way through the castle and petering out a bit. Gonna finish it because I assume I'm fairly close, but the sameness of a lot of the castle's rooms is wearing a bit. Excuse me. I know there have been comments made below before about how this doesn't feel Metroid-like because of the lack of prominent ability-based locks and keys, but for me, it doesn't feel as much like Castlevania because you don't have a whip in your repertoire. Disclosure, I have yet to play either of the Sorrow games or Ruin. Symphony at least has Richter mode. With the variety of glyphs you get, I'm surprised none of them are a whip. That said, story does feel very Castlevania-ish. Yeah, there is no whip. That's sad.
Shinoa kind of whips her hair when you press up.
That's true.
On the D-pad.
And this game whips ass, so.
There's your whip right there.
All right, I'm going to jump ahead to True Death and then let Stuart finish with Porifera because I'm tired of reading really long comments. True Death says, I want to say I liked the game, but it kind of sucked that half the weapons go unused because you get a stronger variant pretty quickly in some cases. Oh, cool, a neat sword glyph. Oh, here's a scythe glyph that's much stronger. Guess I'm never using swords in this game. Yeah, okay. We covered that. I can't disagree. Yeah. Stuart.
Porifera? Welcome back to Retronauts. Says, oh God, I hope I'm here in time. You are, you
he
made it.
He did it.
This is a series of bullet points, and it is about the length of a novel. I'll read it very quickly. I like that the Metroidvania design space can allow for things like this and Metroid 2 on a tangential note that feel familiar but break away from so many of the genre hallmarks. Bullet point 2. I like that its scale feels so modest even when this comes from weird places. For example, the way there are items that sort of suggest a crafting system but are only used one time in a villager quest. This is fine. It keeps the game at 6 to 12 hour mark, which works so well for the genre. That's such a long period though. It's so different. Sorry. Bullet point 3. I don't know why this game felt so hateful and insurmountable when I first played it 10 years ago. It wasn't just the crab boss, though that was a huge part of it. Nowadays, its challenge feels very moderate, especially when you allow for all the cheese tactics. Bullet point 4. With such a relatively small number of offensive options, I do wish there weren't so many that are useless. Bullet point 5. Oh, also, the nature of the glyph system is that it prevents the game from having wacky, weird weapons and historical reference weapons like the previous games. It's a trade-off, I suppose. Bullet point 6. I like the X/Y mashing you have to do to attack. Bullet point 7. Glyph stealing is so cool! I mean, it's not that big of a deal, but it feels so disrespectful and can add a different interesting wrinkle to combat. And finally, the final bullet point. The quality of the room design in this game is all over the place. There's a lot of Jeremy Parrish's patented complaint, enemy box rooms, but then there's also plenty of navigationally interesting stuff too. Thank you for the bullet points. The one I want to quickly comment on, very quickly, I want to do a ROM hack where when you steal a glyph, it puts in a Homer Simpson going, yoink!
I like phrasing it as disrespectful. That's
very funny.
Very accurate. How dare you?
Hey, my magic.
You can't do that. That's not allowed.
but yeah, it is great against the bosses to, you know, just completely prevent them from attacking by stealing their weapon and then using that against them.
Yeah, it's really
good quality
cool.
game design right there.
It's like you're dispelling the spell. It's clever and new. I like it.
I do also agree with the comment that it's disappointing we can't really have the... There's no Lord of the Ring weapons scattered throughout Shanoa's journey, sadly enough. So yeah, that's a good complaint.
Although actually a lot of those weren't really in the game. Those were added in Symphony of the Night by...
Jeremy Blaustein.
Jeremy Blaustein, yeah. So, you know, he was like, I have a literature degree and I'm going to use it. And God bless him for it. It's much more interesting that way.
I think the main wacky weird thing in the game is at the end of the, I can't remember the name of the area, but the challenge area at the end, the second one with the bosses, there's a Jiangshi, like the Chinese hopping vampire, mm-hmm. that you can fight over and over again. And I'm not saying that they're necessarily weirder than other monsters, but they're unexpected.
Yeah.
Especially in Mario Land.
Yeah, but it's like there's a talisman on its face, and when you remove it, it comes after you. When you defeat it, it gets sealed again, but then you can just smack the talisman back off its face and fight it again for more XP, which is a really nice way of alleviating grinding. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's smart.
It's clever.
So we don't really have time for more comments, but we read a lot, and there were even more. A lot of the conversation in Discord was just that conversation, mm-hmm. as opposed to people weighing in. And I think that is a great balance. So thank you everyone who played, who took part in the conversation in Discord. Thank you for, you know, even those of you who didn't leave comments that were the kind of thing you read on a podcast. They still helped keep this conversation going for the past few months, and it was pretty great. And it seemed like everyone had a pretty good time, I would say, ranging from decent to excellent. It doesn't seem like anyone had a bad time, and that's always good to hear. So mm-hmm. I didn't waste your life. I didn't lead you astray.
Nope.
And appreciate you taking part. And also the conversationalists here. Sorry, Chris couldn't be here for this, but... I'm sure he'll make up for it, and other people will drop out in and out, you know, over the course of this. Getting five people together to discuss a video game twice, very challenging. So that's
like hurting cats.
That's why we've got a five-member regular panel, so we can at least have three pretty reliably. We need a quorum, and so look forward to the next episode of the Metroidvania Book Club coming next quarter. Kate Willard, what will the next video game topic be for the Metroidvania Book Club, Volume 2?
So I have two thoughts on this. One is that we go backward to either Circle of the Moon or maybe even Symphony of the Night if people are up for it.
Symphony.
And my other thought is like, what if we went forward and did Prince of Persia, The Lost Crown, which I refer to as Prince of Vania, which I consider one of the greatest Metroidvanias I've ever played. But I'm curious, do people want to go backwards now that we played specifically a Castlevania game, or do we want to try going forwards to a modern game?
As the boss guy here, that's what I'm designating myself. I've got control of the mic and the Zoom channel. I'm going to say, let's not do the same franchise twice in a row. We can come back to Castlevania sometime down the road. But for now, let's go with something different. Prince of Persia sounds great. I've heard good things about it.
Yeah.
Ubisoft really was celebrating its triumph despite laying off the entire team. Very cool, Ubisoft. Awesome. So let's at least, you know, commemorate the hard work that went into that game by tackling it. I love the excuse.
Great. So, now I got to buy something.
Well, because you are a panelist here, a part of this conversation, Retronauts will pay for your copy. Unfortunately, Retronauts community, I'm afraid we're not going to pay for your copy. In fact, you're going to pay for Stuart's copy. That's what the Patreon is for. And of course, conversation about this game, this Metroidvania Book Club endeavor, is gated in our Discord, which of course you know about because you are a subscriber at the $5 level. Yes, this is a patron exclusive episode that you're listening to now, so I don't have to give you the spiel. So thank you for purchasing a copy of Prince of Persia for Stuart and anyone else.
Yeah, could someone nominate Call of Duty, please? Black Ops 6, thanks.
That's the opposite of a Metroidvania. Absolutely not.
Can I give people a little extra credit assignment, too, if they want to get a jump start on The Lost Crown, which is, if you're planning to buy it before you buy it, try playing the demo first. I'm tempted to tell you what I thought about the demo. I don't want you to go in with preconceived notions. Just play the demo before you play the full game. Let us know if you thought the demo was a good representation of the game.
Interesting. Now I'm intrigued. But I do need to ask Kate, because we want this to be a two-part discussion. Is there a natural breaking point within the game that you think, you know, we should tackle for the first episode and then reserve beyond that for the second episode? You don't have to spoil anything, but is there like an item or location or something that you think would be the proper cutoff point for the first phase of discussion for this?
It's a very good question, and I don't know. I'd have to take a look at it again.
Okay. Have a look at it. Let me know. And by the time this comes out on Patreon, we'll go ahead and provide that information in the Discord. And it looks like the first episode discussion will be recording, let's say, June 15th-ish.
Another question for you is, I want to say this is longer than a standard Metroidvania. It could be potentially a three-parter.
Wow. Okay, so your homework assignment, by the time this episode comes out on Patreon, which will be, the 16th, May 16th, figure out how this should be structured. And we'll make that public announcement both on Patreon and in the Discord.
All right.
But yes, I'm excited. I've heard very good things about the new Prince of Persia game. I'm looking forward to finally having an excuse to play my copy of it. So thank you, Retronauts listeners, for not having to buy me a copy of Prince of Persia because I already wasted my money on a game that I haven't touched. Cool, Jeremy. Way to go. Awesome.
Good job, everyone.
That's what having a day job is for.
I'm sure none of us have ever done that before. It's fine. It's not the most common thing in the
world. Anyway, so I need to get going. You need to get going. Right. This podcast needs to get going. But please, everyone, where can we find you on the internet? I don't have to give the spiel about how to subscribe to Retronauts because everyone listening to this already has. But where can we find you and support your works as individuals?
Kate. Search for Critical Kate on Blue Sky and or YouTube.
Nadia.
I am a co-host of the Axe of the Blood God RPG podcast. We cover RPGs old and new, Eastern and Western. You can find us at patreon.com/bloodgodpod. We also stream a lot at Twitch, TV, Blood God Pod. And you can find me on Blue Sky at Nadia Oxford.
Stuart.
You can find me on Retronauts. You can find me on Blue Sky as Stuart Jip. And if you Google my name, you will find all manner of myriad appalling projects that I have attached my wagon to. And also, I have a book out called All Games Are Good, and it's amazing. It's the best book ever written, and you should buy a copy right now. And if you already own a copy, you should buy another copy, because it's probably getting dog-eared from the amount that you've read it.
That's why you get the hardcover copy. All right. Mm-hmm. Finally, you can find me on Blue Sky as Jay Parrish. J-P-A-R-I-S-H. Don't put two R's in there. That's illegal. You can find me doing stuff at limitedrungames.com, such as making cool maps for the Dominus collection of Castlevania. But this episode is not an advertisement for that because the pre-order ship has sailed. You missed out. And you can also find me on YouTube as Jeremy Parrish, where soon, actually by the time this is out, you will be able to see me talking about ALF for Master System.
Yes! Woo! Finally! I have no idea why I'm excited about that. I'm not as excited as I make it out to see, just ALF.
Much like ALF, that game, kill me. Anyway, thanks everyone. Thank you for the ALF laugh, Stuart. All right, good night, folks. Go away, play some Prince of Persia. It's going to be cool. Good night, etc. Bye.
Good night.